journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, September 11th, 2013, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
President Obama makes his case for war with Syria, even as analysts call his evidence into question. We'll speak with Ray McGovern. And the Muslims are coming to a theater near you. Plus, the bizarre world of Miley Cyrus and the message she sends young people.
This is Uprising.
A major explosion rocks Benghazi, Libya, exactly a year after U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens was killed. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Joining us to dissect this and other breaking news headlines is our guest expert, Rahul Mahajan. He's a sociologist and a news analyst and has written the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Good morning, Rahul.
Good morning.
Well, now 12 years after the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, D.C., and 1 year after an attack on a U.S. embassy in Benghazi, a foreign ministry building in Benghazi, Libya, was partially destroyed today by an explosion. The attack is part of an increasing trend of violence targeting Libya's security forces and judiciary. Rahul, the brief U.S.-NATO bombing campaign in Libya 2 years ago that helped topple Muammar Gaddafi could be the most recent model for what Obama would like to do in Syria if indeed the attempts with Russia to thwart an attack fail, this brief targeted campaign that they carried out in Libya. But if today's Libya is any indication, what sort of future could Syria have after a U.S. bombing campaign?
Well, I mean, clearly Libya is in a state of anarchy, chaos, and local tyrannies. And Benghazi alone, the single city, has had more than 60 political assassinations since the civil war ended. So that's an extraordinary rate. I mean, the number of murders obviously is far greater. And for that matter, Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen are not in good shape either. I don't think any of these countries, however, compares to the situation in Syria with an ongoing war. I do think that the situation in Libya is very much on the minds of the Obama administration, and the fact that those who have sort of emerged into power in Libya are not perhaps the most congenial people to the United States has a lot to do with the fact that they are probably not planning a campaign that would actually significantly help the rebels to win, but rather one that would most likely simply prolong the stalemate, because the rebels are now losing and an attack on the other side will actually make the violence go on longer.
In New York City, a mayoral candidate championed by unions and progressives, Bill de Blasio, appears to have won the Democratic Party's primary election, which means that he faces Republican candidate Joe Loda in a general election this fall. Given the current Republican mayor Michael Bloomberg's unpopular policies in support of the NYPD's overreach on things like racial profiling and surveillance and heavy-handedness in general, Rahul, could a win this fall by de Blasio mean a very different future for the nation's financial and cultural epicenter?
Well, I think the win of de Blasio in the primary is very encouraging because, after Anthony Weiner's meltdown, his biggest opponent, Christine Quinn, is considerably more conservative and considerably closer to Michael Bloomberg politically and in terms of the issues. So the fact that he won is a good sign. What the question is, how much is he going to tack back to the right and towards the sort of authoritarian neoliberalism of a Michael Bloomberg in order to try to win New York? This is the kind of politician I instinctively distrust. It's the last guy who talked about, he talks about two New Yorks, the last guy who talked about the two Americas was John Edwards. So he's come out of nowhere. He's now the Democratic nominee. The big question is, Is he going to remain true to the principles that he was espousing when he ran, for the nomination?
And finally, the city of Richmond here in California has just approved a resolution to enable the seizing of properties using eminent domain in order to save homes with underwater mortgages and other financial problems. The Richmond City Council voted 4-3 to approve a collaboration with the group Mortgage Resolution Partners in a move that private mortgage and real estate companies are loudly denouncing. Richmond is one of the poorest cities in California. It also happens to have one of the most progressive mayors, Gail McLaughlin, who championed the resolution that passed. Rahul, other cities like San Bernardino here in Southern California attempted such a move and failed. If Richmond has successfully now passed this resolution and can actually use this method to help people stay in their homes, could it spark a trend in other cities?
Well, this kind of action is certainly very much being thought about. There's a particular issue that, it's one thing to talk about mortgages that are owned by a bank, and dealing with the bank, making a deal to have them write down some of the debt, get things sort of more in tune with the market value, a move that usually will actually increase the bank's, the worth of the loan to the bank, even though its nominal value is smaller. But for securitized mortgages, it's much more difficult because you've got these things spliced and diced and parceled out through God knows how many different owners in different places with very different agendas. And that's why the use of eminent domain is one possibility. It's questionable, certainly. The federal government, the Federal Housing Finance Authority, has already come out strongly against it. But, of course, the interests of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are very much like the interests of other mortgage companies. The big question, I think, is whether this is exactly the best way to do it. Something like this is a good idea, but the particular contours of this plan suggest that it may be in part a way for mortgage resolution partners to use the authority of the city government to make a lot of money on the cheap.
Well, we'll certainly follow the story and see whether it plays out that way. Rahul, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Great to be with you.
Rahul Mahajan is our Daily News Flash guest expert. He is a sociologist and news analyst and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Coming up, we'll analyze President Obama's speech on Syria yesterday, as well as take a look at the intelligence that keeps being cited. And then, The Muslims Are Coming, a new documentary hits theaters this weekend in Southern California. And we'll also take a look at the antics of Miley Cyrus. Race and sex analysis of her recent antics and how they could affect young people, particularly young women. Stay tuned. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. President Obama last night addressed the nation to make his case publicly for military action on Syria, invoking details of a scenario in which Syrian forces gassed over 1,000 Syrians to death and claiming that such a scenario was backed up by evidence of the regime evaluating the attack afterward. The president made the case that the U.S. had to act in order to send a message about the use of chemical weapons, despite public reluctance to get involved in another war. Obama also stated that he had urged a postponement of the Senate vote on his resolution to authorize force in order to see how a Russia-brokered deal with Syria over its chemical arsenal might play out. Analysts see the delay as more of an indication of the lack of current congressional support for the bill. And finally, invoking the rhetoric of American exceptionalism, the president held up an image of the U.S.'s role as a global superpower, upholding the rule of international law and making the world a better place. Meanwhile, the intelligence, which ostensibly prompted a plan for military force, is still being questioned, despite White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough's proclamation in interviews that, quote, the entire world believes that President Assad used chemical weapons. In fact, an open letter sent to President Obama by a group of former intelligence analysts asserts that colleagues in the intelligence community have privately confirmed the flimsiness of the evidence. Apparently, an intercepted message within the Syrian government acknowledges the chemical attack, but expresses surprise at it. One of the signees of the letter is Ray McGovern, who served as a CIA analyst for 27 years. He conducted one-on-one morning briefings for President Reagan's most senior national security officials. McGovern says that if President Obama really wants to make his case for war, he should release the details of the evidence, much like Reagan did in justifying the U.S.'s 1986 bombing of Libya. Ray now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's take a listen to President Obama's speech yesterday, where he brings up a scenario, describes a scenario that he is essentially saying is what really happened in the gas attack in Syria.
In the days leading up to August 21st, we know that Assad's chemical weapons personnel prepared for an attack near an area where they mix sarin gas. They distributed gas masks to their troops. Then they fired rockets from a regime-controlled area into 11 neighborhoods that the regime has been trying to wipe clear of opposition forces. Shortly after those rockets landed, the gas spread, and hospitals filled with the dying and the wounded. We know senior figures in Assad's military machine reviewed the results of the attack, and the regime increased their shelling of the same neighborhoods in the days that followed. We've also studied samples of blood and hair from people at the site that tested positive for sarin.
And that is President Obama speaking yesterday at the White House and addressing the public. Now, Ray McGovern, what do you make of this detailed scenario that he describes? How real is it, and what evidence is there that that is how it played out?
Well, Sonali, it could be very real. But I would suggest that after all that's happened, and I don't mean just over the last 12 years, I mean going back to the Gulf of Tonkin, when I was around and I saw that the president knew the second incident did not happen, and yet it ended up being used as justification for the whole war, I was around for Iraq. Granted, I was retired, but the evidence was abundant that we were being snuckered into another war. And we said so. We veteran intelligence professionals for sanity warned the president in 3 official memos before the attack on Iraq. So this time around, you know, it seems a little much, frankly, for the president to say, we know, or for John Kerry to say on the 30th of August, we know, how many times? 35 times. Now, the assessment that he released, which, by the way, on the 30th of August, was not an intelligence assessment. It was a, quote, government assessment, end quote, the first time in my 50 years that I've run across this new genre. What does that mean? That means that the White House put this out very clearly. It's on the White House letterhead, so to speak, not intelligence letterhead. And it means that the White House had time to massage it, to edit it, to add to it, to make it appear as it wanted it to appear. Even so, some hardy soul insisted that embedded in that 4-page assessment were the words that this lacks confirmation. Yeah, we have high confidence that we're doing right assessment, but this lacks confirmation. Now, am I prepared to believe what the president said last night? Yeah, I'm prepared. But, you know, I don't do faith-based intelligence.
Now, the letter that you signed with your colleagues in the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity group cites that there are sources that you have, that you know of in the intelligence community that are privately sharing information with you and others that calls into question this evidence. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, Sonali, that's a good question, of course. In addition to all the circumstantial evidence and all the reasons to doubt this based on history, there are some, well, how shall I call them, courageous souls willing to take the risk that they were unwilling to take 12 years ago. That's about sums it up. There are a lot of people with really guilty consciences who knew that the evidence before Iraq was not mistaken. It was fraudulent, okay? And Senator Rockefeller, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has said that publicly. Fraudulent. And, you know, many of them feel, gosh, you know, if I had spoken out, if I had broken ranks and gone to the
Well, it wouldn't be the Post or the Times because they would have asked the president if they could publish it. If I had gone to KPFA with that information and with my bona fides as an insider, took that risk, would they, you know, millions of people would not be in the situation they are today. So those same people are still around.
And so as far as you know, of course, you may not know the details of the evidence that's there, but we're hearing that all the evidence that the Obama administration might have and be using to justify this scenario is that there was clearly discussion of the attack in the Bashar al-Assad regime among its top circles, but acknowledgement that the incident happened and perhaps even some surprise that the incident happened, which may indicate that they may not have been the ones to carry out this attack, even if they have carried out other attacks in the past, and even if they, of course, do have a serious chemical weapons arsenal.
That's right. And in addition to all this, we're being asked by McDonough on Sunday, the chief of staff in the White House, you know, apply common sense here. Apply common sense. Well, all right, let's apply common sense. The UN inspectors had just arrived in Syria 2 days before this event. Now, what common sense does it make for Bashar al-Assad to perpetrate this incident when the UN inspectors are already there and ready to investigate it? Well, that's not common sense to me. You know, it's really very, very telling that the president and his minions will not release the evidence. They have ample precedent for doing this. You know, when I was still on active duty, so to speak, with the CIA, there was that terrible incident where there was a bombing in Berlin, a terrorist bombing at a discotheque. Two U.S. servicemen were killed, scores were injured, 230 people were injured, okay? Now, Ronald Reagan knew, because we told him, that there was an intercepted message encoded from Tripoli to Berlin and back, indicating beyond any doubt that the Libyans were responsible. That was the 5th of April, 1986. On the 15th of April, Ronald Reagan sent 60-90 planes to destroy the palace in Tripoli, and also Benghazi, by the way, killed Gaddafi's 15-month-old daughter, severely injured his youngest son, 3 years old, and the world was in high dudgeon. The world was, you know, saying, what are you doing? What's your proof that Libya did this? And Reagan came to us and he says, you know, we have to release that message. And of course we said, no, you can't do that. You'd be blowing our source. And he said, release it. We released the message. You know, I have to clarify here, I don't condone killing little kids because of a bombing of a disco in Berlin, but at least the president at that time, Reagan, had what we might call a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, okay? And he said, I owe this to the world. We did have the evidence. It was retaliation for a real event, so I'm going to release it. Now, did we blow the source? Yeah, we blew the source. Do we have no other sources? No comment on that.
Mm.
In this case, I can imagine the Syrians would be shocked out of their minds to realize, to hear, to know, to have confirmed that we eavesdrop on their conversations. Can you imagine what a shock that would be? I speak with great irony, of course,
given
all disclosures. So there's no reason in the world why Obama cannot follow this precedent set in 1986, and there's been other precedents, and it feeds suspicions, including in my mind. Why don't they do it? And the only logical conclusion, if we want to apply, quote, common sense, end quote, again, is that the evidence is so flimsy that it cannot bear close scrutiny.
Now, Ray, the situation, of course, is quite fluid. And while the Senate was expected to vote today, by all measures and estimates last week, everybody thought that the Senate would vote, the House would vote, Obama would have his authority, and we'd be raining bombs by the end of the week. Well, that scenario has certainly changed significantly. It's possible that it has simply been postponed till President Obama either gets enough congressional international support or decides to forego it and go through it anyway. And they're citing the Russia-brokered deal with Syria to have the United Nations, with the support of countries like France and Britain, to have a resolution that would put in place a commitment by Syria to have its chemical weapons under international control. And President Obama said this in his speech yesterday about that particular move.
The Assad regime has now admitted that it has these weapons and even said they joined the Chemical Weapons Convention, which prohibits their use. It's too early to tell whether this offer will succeed, and any agreement must verify that the Assad regime keeps its commitments. But this initiative has the potential to remove the threat of chemical weapons without the use of force, particularly because Russia is one of Assad's strongest allies. I have therefore asked the leaders of Congress to postpone a vote to authorize the use of force while we pursue this diplomatic path.
And Ray McGovern, what is happening right now has sparked a storm of speculation, both among lawmakers as well as ordinary Americans and in the media. But what exactly is going on here? Is it possible that President Obama realizes not only does he lack public and congressional support for this war and so may actually not bomb? Or is it that John Kerry's faux pas on Monday, saying that if Assad were to turn over his arsenal, he could actually avoid the war, is now being turned into a trigger for war, because all we have to do is say, OK, we said Assad could turn over the weapons, and we say that our secret intelligence says, well, he hasn't turned over all the weapons, so now we're going to bomb. What do you think is really going on here?
Well, we've been spared a new war, and we should rejoice in that. I mean,
do you think it's a done deal?
It's a done deal that there's not going to be any attack on Syria for the next several weeks and probably several months.
Hmm.
What the Russians did was throw Obama a lifeline. He had no support internationally. Congress, even the Senate, was about to vote him down. And the Russians said, look, we can deliver the Syrians, okay? We can make this okay for you. You can even brag at having brandished your sword and having had an effect. Just let us do this. And Obama grabbed the lifeline despite all the neocons and all the people with very sad faces that I saw at CNN two nights ago, and he faced into it. So there's not going to be any attack on Syria. Dempsey and the other generals are breathing a huge sigh of relief because what they were asked to do cannot be done in a military sense, despite the urgings of the young folks in the White House, and the tough guys and the tough gals. So we've been spared that, and we should be able to, kind of say, all right, this was tough. 12 days ago, it looked like a done deal that there's going to be an attack. General Dempsey, and I have to say this for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he obviously intervened on that crucial Friday night. Why do I say that? Because when the president got up Saturday, and you can hear us demonstrating outside the White House mm-hmm. in the background.
You were there?
You can hear us demonstrating outside in the background. What the president said was, look, I've talked to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he says that there's no urgency to this. We could do it today, or we could do it tomorrow, or next week, or next month. Now, that was something, because Dempsey, of course, has always counseled against this. And how do I know that that he was effective? Because of the vitriol that Lindsey Graham and Senator McCain spewed out when they visited the White House the next day, saying the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has counseled the president this way and that way. He's wrong, and we need to attack anyway. So the military spoke. They overrode the folks with still wet behind the ears in the White House, at the UN, and elsewhere. So that's the good news. And is the Russians' role, is that a bad thing? No, it's a very good thing. I know a little bit about Russian history. I used to know more about that than American history. They have a soft underbelly. Okay, Syria is not Iraq. Since Catherine the Great in the 18th century, since Moscow extended its reach to its southern underbelly, they've been always very, very, very sensitive and tender there. And so if they're in the deal here, They have as much incentive to deprive people like Assad of his chemical weapons as anyone else does. Now, there is a danger that they play games here.
Right.
They could say, well, you know, while we're at it, we should ban all weapons of mass destruction from the Middle East. Ooh.
Israel.
Put the kibosh on the whole thing.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. I hope you're right, Ray, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Ray McGovern, veteran CIA analyst who has briefed many presidents. By the way, he wrote an op-ed in the Miami Herald called "To Persuade Skeptics About Syria, Obama Should Follow Reagan's Example." We'll post that on uprisingradio.org later today. Ray McGovern is also co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and you can check out his website online at raymcgovern.com. That's raymcgovern.com. This is Uprising. After this short break, the new documentary, The Muslims Are Coming. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly citizen, investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com. Join me for The Bradcast every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. 1 hour of troublemaking and muckraking ripped from the pages of bradblog.com and sometimes from the dark recesses of my mind. We'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers, we'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys if we can find any. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. We'll report on politics, elections, election reform, mainstream corporate media failure, media reform, global warming denialism, and everything before, during, and after. Join me for The Bradcast every Wednesday, now a full hour, 3 to 4 p.m., right here on Pacifica Radio's KPFK and coast to coast and around the globe on KPFK.org.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Right-wing talk show hosts are up in arms over a planned march today in Washington, D.C., organized by the American Muslim Public Affairs Committee to draw attention to post-9/11 Islamophobia. The march, which was originally entitled Million Muslim March, was renamed to Million American March Against Fear. Apparently, conservatives are upset about the march being held on the anniversary of September 11th, have planned a counter-motorcycle protest. Now, a new documentary attempts to take on the industry of Islamophobia in the U.S. It's called simply The Muslims Are Coming. Co-directed by two Muslim comedians, Dean Obidallah and Negin Farsad, The Muslims Are Coming chronicles a daring national comedy tour in an attempt to quell American Islamophobia. Here's a clip from the film.
Hey guys, how's everybody doing?
I'm an Iranian-American Muslim female.
Where are my muzzies at? Come on guys, where are my muzzies at? Sweet!
I thought for sure Islamophobia would die down since we were so many years out of 9/11. But then with the election of Barack Obama, this thing started happening where everyone was accusing him of being a Muslim.
Is Barack Obama a Muslim?
It was alarming to me that being a Muslim became an accusation.
The president's problem is that he was born a Muslim.
To me, the most shocking thing, honestly, was the opposition to the Ground Zero Mosque. I never saw a rally in America against a religion before. Thousands of people with horrific signs saying demonizing comments about Muslims simply because of their faith. To me, it was a wake-up call that something was wrong. We just felt like we have to do something. We're going on a tour. We're going to Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. I'm not kidding. Northern Florida in 2 weeks. It's called The Muslims Are Coming. It's a one-way trip.
That's a clip from the film The Muslims Are Coming. It opens this Friday at the Downtown Independent Cinema for a week-long run, after which it'll be available on iTunes, Amazon, and cable on demand. Dean Obidallah is an award-winning comedian who appeared on numerous television news shows. He writes regularly for CNN.com and The Huffington Post. Negin Farsad is an acclaimed Iranian-American comedian and actress. She's also won many awards and accolades. The two of them co-directed The Muslims Are Coming, and they now join me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising, Dean and Negin.
Thank you. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, one of the most important facts that I felt like I learned from this documentary was that all American turkeys are halal. Is that in fact true, Dean? And if so, how did that even happen?
No, I don't think they're all halal. I think at that time, Butterball Turkey was providing halal turkeys just like they would provide kosher turkeys for certain, you know, members of their buying community. So that's all that was. But unfortunately, to people who really don't like Muslims, the idea that Butterball Turkey would offer that to people who would want to buy it, and you're not forced to buy it. You don't have to buy the halal turkey. They were upset by it. Somehow it was a way of imposing Sharia poultry law in America, which I don't even know if it exists. But that kind of stuff makes us laugh, frankly. It's so over the top. It's so ridiculous that. That's why I love the fact that we can mock it, because I think one of the greatest responses to bigots is people laughing at them, and I think that really irritates them. They'd rather you get angry, but when you're laughing at them, it completely undermines their credibility, and that's one of the goals of the film.
Well, and the turkey tastes the same either way.
Tastes like chicken, either way.
So before we get to the tour itself, the comedy tour that the film chronicles, let's talk about the context within which the two of you made this film. One of the things that I remember is that it seems as though anti-Muslim propaganda is even stronger today than in the months and years immediately following September 11th. A big part of that may have to do with the election of President Obama. But Nagin, how serious is it? How do non-Muslim Americans put themselves in your shoes to get a sense of how bad it is for Muslims in the U.S. today?
You know, I mean, it's true. Like, that time, you know, it was really interesting. I mean, after 9/11, there was a spike in Islamophobia, but then it sort of died down, and then it just sort of reemerged with the election of Barack Obama, with the Park 51 controversy, where it suddenly became really kind of sensational to use being Muslim as an accusation. And I think that kind of rhetoric in the public space was what was really shocking. And I think maybe, I don't know that a lot of people understand what it's like to just hear your religion bandied about as an accusation. So even just on a level of like media discourse, you know what I mean? And so I think that's one of the things that's shocking to me about the form that the Islamophobia has taken in the public square, is that just saying Muslim is like a dirty word. You know, if you want to be like, so-and-so is like Muslim, you have to like kind of whisper it, because it could be just seen as an accusation. And the labeling always, you know, you never say Christian killer so-and-so. It's always like, you know, it's just like some guy so-and-so is a murderer, whatever, you know. But when the person is brown or when they're Muslim, the race and ethnicity play into it, race, ethnicity, and religion play into it. And Muslim means a lot of things to people. It means brown. It means immigrant. It means stifler of women's freedoms. It means, you know, there's a lot of, it's become a very loaded term. So I feel like that's where we are right now with it.
Now, Dean, the comedy tour that you entitled The Muslims Are Coming, which is, of course, the title of the documentary as well, how did you put together the lineup, and how did you choose the places in the United States that you wanted to visit?
Well, the first part, we picked comedians that we knew who were funny, and we knew they were going to be funny to mainstream audiences, not just, because there's certain comics in every ethnic group, or, you know, little subsect that can play to their audience great. But we needed comics who were Muslim but also played to really a broad scope of audience members, because the audiences we were trying to attract were not Muslim. We wanted non-Muslims to come to see us, because Muslims know there's good and bad in us. You know, it's the non-Muslims we're trying to reach out to. So that was part of it. It had to do with the challenge was finding people who would do it for almost free, frankly, and spend this much time on the road with us. And the places we picked, I mean, we went to places where we thought they had the least amount of Muslims in certain cases, you know, in the South and the West. And we also went to places that had a history of some problems with Muslims. I mean, we went to Gainesville, Florida, because that's where Terry Jones, the Quran burner, is based. We went to Murfreesboro, Tennessee, because there was a mosque controversy down there. And we wanted to do shows where we could bring people together. I mean, the goal of the tour and the documentary is not to demonize people. It's really to bring Americans of all faiths together to laugh as Americans and celebrate this melting pot that we truly are. And sometimes it gets lost on people, that people turn on each other. We just don't have disagreements. We have accusations that you're not as American as the other person because you're not the same religion or the same race or ethnicity. So it's really our goal is to make it heal, but at the same level, we are poking fun through comedy at some of the most outrageous bigots out there.
Yeah, and in fact, Nagin, let me ask you that. In the film, you say the goal of the tour was to, quote, give America this big Muslim hug. Why why is comedy a useful tool, if you will, for better understanding between Muslims and non-Muslims, and really for Americans to get a better understanding of who Muslims are?
I think I think fun is the biggest tool for getting people to understand about Muslims. And it works, I think, in every kind of educational system, right? We're like, in science class, you do little experiments or whatever so you can see the thing catch on fire or whatever it is, because it's more fun. I mean, it gets people interested. And comedy is kind of like the ultimate in fun. You know, you go to a show, you laugh, you have a good time, you have a couple of drinks, you talk with your friends after, you remember some of the jokes. The association you build with the issue becomes a positive and fun and engaging one, rather than, I went to a lecture, I was really nodding off, it was boring, and, you know what I mean, I wanted to kill myself. Like, that's not the association we want to build for people. We want people to be like, oh, I've never met a Muslim, and I'm going to see this movie, and it turns out this movie is really fun, and I had a good time.
And is comedy,
that's going to have a bigger effect.
Is comedy also a way to turn stereotypes on its head? On their heads?
Yeah, and we always deal with this, I think, as comedians in general, whenever you're dealing with any kind of racial, ethnic, religious stereotype, is like there's a fine line between feeding into the stereotype and turning the stereotype on its head, right? So you have to, like, really tread that line. We don't really do very many airplane jokes and stuff. We don't really do any, because those are kind of things, it's like you don't want to, like, reiterate those kinds of things in the public space, because that's not remotely true. That's a stereotype that's so ridiculous that, you know, we try and kind of stay away from those things now. I mean, but at the same time, even just mentioning it in a really ridiculous context shows how completely absurd it is to think that all Muslims are dangerous on planes, you know?
Right.
It's something that comedy is really good at, and it's also, like, the responsibility is on the comedians to make sure they're not feeding into it and that they are, in fact, turning it on its head.
Now, Dean, in your tour, mm-hmm. I noticed that before you played each venue, you would attempt to reach out to the local community to get them to attend these free shows. You started out in Columbus, Georgia, and it wasn't, let's just say the tour started with more of a whimper than a bang.
Yes. It didn't start out well, and it was very disheartening because we're out there on the road doing these free shows. We're sweating. It's August, and you have like 20 people in a venue, and it almost seemed like it was comedy by ambush. I mean, they sort of knew they were going to be a comedy show, but it was not a theater or a comedy club. It was a hookah bar, a hookah lounge, and we really couldn't find any place in that area, but we wanted to do a show in that town because there's a big military base, and we were really trying to get people from the military to come see our show. And so it was a challenge, and you're out there as a comedian. You just tend to show up for your shows, or if you're touring, you do some press. We were actually handing out flyers during the day, right before the show, going to venues, going to different events like the gun show, and handing out flyers. And that's what we did in city after city. We didn't want to replicate that in the movie over and over, but every city, that was what we followed. It was a long days, and then you, after handing out flyers and talking to people all day, then you'd go on stage and try to make people laugh. And it was challenging, but it was really fulfilling at the end of the day.
I mean, Columbus didn't do well, but it was disheartening to hand out flyers for people not to come. But the other cities were kind of really successful in terms of turnout and in terms of people supporting the show. So that was also really surprising.
Tell
Columbus
us about,
made us appreciate the other shows a lot. I can tell you that.
Nagin, tell us about Lawrenceville. You tried a different tactic. You set up an Ask a Muslim booth. What kinds of questions did you get from people?
Yeah, in the Ask a Muslim booth in Lawrenceville was really fun because, we wanted to see what kind of questions people had of Muslims, and it turns out they have a few very specific questions that get repeated over and over. And one of them is, why are you dressed like that, to me? Because I just dressed like a regular girl or whatever. There's nothing particularly Muslim, stereotypically Muslim about how I'm dressed. And so that was very confusing to people. And so it was fun for us to kind of explain to them, like, oh, actually, like, you know, according to the Quran, you can kind of do whatever you want within, you know, whatever your sense of moderation is. And this is, this is what I think it is, so it's cool. And it involves cleavage sometimes, so that was one of the main questions we had. Another question, another really, really big question was, why don't Muslims denounce terrorism?
Right.
And that was a real stunner. And it's not the first time we've heard it, but it was just to hear it kind of over and over again was really something else, because it made us realize that, like, the, you know, the effect of you know, mainstream media is that makes it seem like Muslims don't denounce terrorism. And, you know, and it's sad because so many Muslim groups in the United States after 9/11, after any incident, go out and say, we denounce this, we denounce this, we denounce this. And, of course, it's, you know, we're the only group that's kind of expected to sit around denouncing things. You know, I think Lewis Black made a really funny point in the movie that, like, Catholics don't denounce every time there's, like, a child molestation situation or whatever, right, that they don't denounce white people or whatever. And so that's, you know, that's one of the big questions that we got, and we you know, it was interesting to see that it was so pervasive.
Dean, the film The Muslims Are Coming also features non-Muslim comedians like Jon Stewart and also just social commentators like Rachel Maddow. Why did you bring that viewpoint, or why did you choose to feature some other voices in the film?
Well, we wanted to be diverse. There might actually be more Jewish people in the film than Muslims. I haven't done the math yet between Jon Stewart and Lewis Black and David Cross and many of the comedians. But we didn't want it to be... We wanted to be this broad-based support. We wanted to show people there was a coalition of good people out there, and they don't care what faith they happen to be. They're standing up for freedom of religion for all Americans. And in this case, we just happen to be Muslim. The same way, if someone who was Jewish was being persecuted, I would gladly stand with them, or a Christian sect that was being persecuted, or Mormons, or atheists. So, you know, the people from this progressive background who just embrace the idea that this nation stands for, that freedom of religion is for all people. There's not more, you don't get more freedoms because you're a certain faith, you're a majority faith, and you don't get less because you're a minority. And for them, as I've said over and over, the film is not really about Islam. It's really about America. Mm. And what do you view this country as being? Is it one where everyone is truly treated the same, regardless of your religious faith, or are there certain ones that get more rights than others? And this film is about saying we're all in this together. All Americans should be treated together the same. And on some level, it's also about minority empowerment, I guess, the Muslim part of it. But it's really a movie about America. And we were ecstatic these people wanted to be in it. We never thought most of them would ever agree to be in it.
Dean Obidala and Negin Farsad are my guests. The two of them are acclaimed Muslim comedians here in the United States, and they've co-directed the new documentary, The Muslims Are Coming. It's opening this Friday at the Downtown Independent Theater, 251 South Main Street in Los Angeles. And you can find out details at uprisingradio.org a little later today, and also find a link where you can buy the tickets. But if you'd like a pair of tickets to this Friday's 7 p.m. screening of the film, call us right now at 818-985-KPFK. We have three pairs of free tickets to give to our listeners. Those of you who have not won anything in the past 3 months, please do call us and enjoy the documentary, The Muslims Are Coming, this Friday at 7 p.m. at the Downtown Independent Theater. If you happen to be a member of KPFK's Film Club, by the way, this is also on offer through that Film Club, and you can listen to our announcements about that during this week. Again, that phone number, 818-985-5735, for a pair of tickets to see The Muslims Are Coming. We only have three free pairs.
Oh, Muslims, you know they are coming. They're gentle and they're friendly. So open up your arms and give them a hug. Muslims, you know they are so chummy. They're super cute and fluffy. Not like your Sharpay. Hey, that's a cute dog. American
The Muslims Are Coming. That's from the film itself. And by the way, I want to make a very sad announcement. Speaking of films and filmmakers, the documentarian Saul Landau passed away earlier this week. He was a prolific award-winning documentarian who traveled the world profiling political leaders like Cuba's Fidel Castro and Chile's Salvador Allende. He died at the age of 77 and was battling bladder cancer for 2 years. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We turn now to an issue of pop culture that has captivated the media as well as audiences nationwide. While some people might dismiss the antics of a 20-year-old pop star's television performance as juvenile and irrelevant, others would find a disturbing commentary on the status of women in our society. Miley Cyrus's performance last weekend at the Video Music Awards caused quite a stir as viewers watched her twerking on stage dressed in her underwear. Cyrus subjected an all-black group of backup dancers to slaps on the buttocks as she gyrated around the stage and against a male pop star. Adding to the controversy surrounding her is the release of her new music video this week called Wrecking Ball. The video, which has gotten more than 42 million views so far, has broken all internet viewing records. In it, Cyrus sits atop a giant wrecking ball, completely nude. Critics have been quick to point out the racism inherent in Cyrus's work, particularly in her performance at VMA, and others have railed against the porn-like images which run throughout her videos and performances. The most disturbing fact about her pop cultural standing is that her enormous fan base stems mainly from very young girls who started following her when she played Hannah Montana on the Disney Channel. Joining me to talk about the influence of Miley Cyrus on our culture and give us a critical analysis of her is Akiba Solomon, the managing editor of Color Lines magazine. Welcome to Uprising, Akiba.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Miley Cyrus isn't the first female pop star to use sex and very highly sexualized images to gain fame. Of course, we think back to Madonna and others. But why is she different, or is she different from performers like Madonna and others?
Well, I don't think she's actually very different from other performers. I mean, she's taken a classic formula of appropriating certain aspects of a culture that isn't hers. She is selling sex. And also there's actually an underlying drug theme to some of her work as well. If you look at the video for It's Our Party, there she sniffs and she makes a couple of other
gestures
that suggest that drugs are involved. And so, you know, sex, drugs, appropriation, that's a pretty familiar formula for popularity in this country.
Now, let's talk about the sort of racial analysis, and you alluded to it just now. I mean, of course, many musicians over the years have appropriated African-American music trends and genres, but does Miley Cyrus go beyond appropriation?
Well, she does. I mean, I think the big issue with Miley Cyrus, aside from the fact that she's attempting to appropriate something, is that she does it so poorly. I mean, people talk about how she's twerking, but actually the move that she's doing, according to the New Orleans bounce performer Big Frida, she's actually doing a move called Exercise. And so, you know, for her to, for all of a sudden ABC News and a bunch of mainstream publications to have these explainers around twerking and twerking becoming synonymous with Miley Cyrus, when actually all she's doing is gyrating, is problematic. And aside from that, what she's doing is she's actually using black bodies, black female bodies to legitimize herself. And she uses bits and pieces of those bodies without showing the faces of these women, without giving them any sort of identity. And it harkens back to a minstrel show. I mean, it's really problematic in that she puts on the clothes, you know, figuratively, she puts on the clothes of women of color, but she doesn't ever deal with the experiences of women of color except for how they relate to her. And so, you know, she's taken sort of a mockery of this idea of twerking, and she's really sort of hypercharged it.
Now, in terms of the way in which she treated her black female colleagues on stage at the Video Music Awards, why was that something that, and you know, perhaps a lot of white audiences watching that may not have even noticed what was happening there, but can you tease out some of the racial dynamics going on stage over there?
Well, I just think, I think that people were able to recognize that something was wrong because it was so blatant. The fact that her dancers had on teddy bear costumes, You know, so she wasn't backed up. It isn't that sort of 80s performance where you have the white performer and then you have a gospel choir in the background giving that person some sort of depth or legitimacy. This is literally, you know, women, half-naked women in teddy bear outfits gyrating around so you can't even really see their faces. And then they turn around and it turns out to be a bunch of black dancers. And there's this one moment during that performance where she slaps the behind of a burlesque dancer named Amazon Ashley, but never shows her face. And so, the blatant show of disrespect in terms of using black women's bodies is just so, it was so blatant that it was hard to miss, I think. I think what she's doing is she's creating, or she's using black women's bodies as products. I mean, that's basically what she's doing with her performance. And the big problem with that, obviously, is that it dehumanizes black women. Now, she would argue that, you know, people are reading too much into it. She did an interview with MTV afterwards where she said that people have thought about her performance more than she did. But I think that there's something really, really sort of sinister and insidious about what Miley Cyrus is doing, whether she's conscious of it or not, that says that black women's bodies are for her consumption, and that basically they're there to lend legitimacy to her when it's convenient for her.
And also it doesn't acknowledge the fact that racism becomes internalized. When you do internalize racism, you don't have to think about it.
Right, right. I mean, no, you don't. You definitely don't have to think about it. And, you know, she has this famous quote where she went to producers and said that she wanted music that sounded more black. And so this is how she's finding herself to become, you know, a mature, I suppose, and growing out of her Hannah Montana image. And the way she's planning to do that is to take certain tropes of black people or what she associates with black culture, including buttocks, including trap music, including gyrating. And these are supposed to be the things that signal that she is a, you know, an adult with a healthy sexuality. And there's something just so racist about even that idea, that she just takes these really stereotypical trappings and this is what she does to break out of her image as a child star.
Now let's talk about the other aspect too, of course, Miley Cyrus's work, and that has been commented on, I think, more broadly by the media, which is a sort of pornification of female pop stars that she is very much promoting as well. I forced myself to sit through her last video so that I could say that I watched it in participating in its critique, and I have to say it was very disturbing to see a young woman leave nothing to the imagination, because she, you know, it just really looked as though her role models were likely to be some kind of, you know, the pornification of our culture. I mean, I don't even have the words to describe it. Well, Akiva, what do you think? I mean, have you seen what she's, have you seen her latest video?
Yeah, I did see Wrecking Ball, and I thought, I mean, the thing about the video is it's just a very, very coarse, very obvious, very literal rendering of this idea that emotionally she's been in a relationship where she served as a wrecking ball. You know, you think about the parts where she's literally licking dumbbells. And
yeah.
I mean, that's sort of...
Or sledgehammer, I think it was, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so it's just like, you know, I want to be sexy, so I'm going to lick a sledgehammer. I mean, that is so... It's just so obvious, and I think that it's hard for her to outdo the sort of sexuality of other artists that she's competing with, so she has to go with the lowest common denominator. You know, naked on a wrecking ball is really pretty, it's really pretty coarse.
And also, she's not. It doesn't seem like she's doing much different, anything terribly different from what a lot of female pop stars feel like they have to do. One interesting a female musician who seems to have taken a different take is Janelle Monáe, a wonderful African American R&B singer who has very strongly she has her own label, and she has actually taken a very strong stand. Very very overtly saying that she refuses to dress the way in which people expect her to dress. It's considered so normal these days for young female pop stars to dress scantily in order to sell records, it seems.
Well, you know, I actually think I don't have a problem with female artists dressing scantily if they really have agency over their bodies and this is something that they want to do. I don't have a problem with it. I think the issue becomes this idea that you have to dress that way to become successful. And that makes you a viable artist if you don't wear any clothes. And I think that Miley Cyrus shows us that, you know, there's this idea out there that to become an adult performer, you have to wear fewer clothes. But you're right that Janelle Monáe actually challenges that status quo by wearing what she calls her uniform, which is a commemoration of her folks back in Kansas City who were maids and who were sort of working class people who wore uniforms to work. And so she calls that her uniform. But she has a self-concept and idea of her art that is so far beyond a Miley Cyrus that it's almost sort of criminal to put them in the same category, in my opinion, because Miley Cyrus is really just, again, to me, the lowest common denominator. And then you have someone like Janelle Monáe who has her own kind of world. I mean, she's constructed a world with her work.
All right. Well, Akiba, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Where's the best place that listeners can get a hold of your writings?
On colorlines.com, I have a column called Gender Matters, so you can go to colorlines.com/gendermatters.
And that is colorlines.com/gendermatters. We will link to that on our website, as well as the piece that you put together critiquing Miley Cyrus. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Akiba Solomon is, again, the managing editor of Color Lines magazine. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Janelle Monáe once said, "I feel myself becoming the fearless person I have dreamt of being. Have I arrived? No, but I'm constantly evolving and challenging myself to be unafraid to make mistakes." That's Janelle Monáe, the alternative pop star for young women to look to if they choose. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our assistant producer. Teddy Robb Robinson is our engineer. Our website is uprisingradio.org, where you can listen to the show and share it on your social networks, post comments, and find links and events we mention on the air. Like us at facebook.com/uprisingradio, follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio, and send your story ideas to mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kohatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8. Tiptoe on a stiff rope bound to, I tiptoe on a stiff rope bound to, tiptoe.